You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's a roundup of world news. Yevgeny Prigozhin's dramatic march on Moscow comes up short, but can Ukraine now capitalize on chaos in Russia? Also, protests in Paris after a teenager is killed by police, and why are South Koreans getting younger? All the biggest stories from around the globe on the Friday News Roundup. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, in a ruling released yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority struck down the use of race-based affirmative action for college admissions. In the ruling against Harvard and the University of North Carolina, the 6-3 majority said colleges may no longer consider race and ethnicity when screening student applicants. UW-Madison Chancellor Jennifer Mnuchin says the ruling means the flagship university will be making modifications to how it selects new students, but says that racial diversity is still a bedrock value. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this U.S. Supreme Court decision? Right call, wrong call? What would you like to know about that decision ending the use of race as a factor in college admissions? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Anuj Desai is a law professor at the UW Law School. Anuj, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. I'm great. It's great to be here.
Let's look at the majority decision first. What were their main grounds for ruling against the universities in this case?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think the first and most important thing to understand about the opinion is that the majority was very, very skeptical of the way in which universities, particularly Harvard and UNC, have been using race in the past. And in particular, I think they basically decided that the articulation of what the universities have been doing, the so-called diversity rationale, was too nebulous to be what the law refers to as a compelling government interest. And moreover, the way in which the universities were actually implementing the programs felt a little bit too much like a quota type system. They don't say exactly that, but that's you can sort of see the seeds of that in their opinion. So that's really the sort of core that you know, under the Equal Protection Clause for public universities and under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act for private universities that are receiving federal funds, you shouldn't use race in a way that affects some people based on their race.
Yeah, the justification, I think, over the years has gone from something like we are, giving, say, students of color a boost in the admissions process to redress a historical wrong or to benefit those students who might not have opportunities. It's been that idea that all students, I think universities have argued, benefit from having a more diverse campus. Has that been kind of the state of the art in justifying using race as a factor in admissions?
Yes, that's exactly right, Rob. Prior to the 1978 Bakke decision, the broad understanding was exactly the way you've described it, that it was recompense. It was, Lyndon Johnson said, you don't shackle a man for hundreds of years and then put him up at the starting line and expect him to run the same race. So that basic idea was what motivated affirmative action plans, and it's how people, I think, thought of them. But in the Bakke case, only four justices of the Supreme Court agreed that was a sufficient rationale, and the middle justice, Justice Powell, decided that the diversity rationale, including racial diversity, was the rationale that he would sign on to. And since he was the sort of median voter, so to speak, the one that tipped it over, his view became the prevailing view. And so since then, universities have framed these programs through that diversity rationale. And that's the rationale that the, you know, that the Supreme Court in the Students for Fair Admissions case on Thursday, you know, found a little bit too nebulous, to be perfectly honest.
And can you talk about now the Equal Protections Clause and how it applies here? The plaintiffs, I gather, argue that, you know, as, say, a white student, or I think in some cases, Asian American students, they say, you know, whatever the motivation here is for race-based preferences, nudges up in the application process, I lose. I'm being discriminated against. Is that the core of what the court ended up deciding?
Yeah, that is the core. Yeah. I mean, the basic idea, and, you know, maybe I should back up, you know, that the decision only applies for public universities and private universities that receive federal funds. Now, to be fair, you know, most universities,
of them, yeah.
That's most of them. There's no doubt about that. And then, you know, it also only applies to selective universities, right? There are a lot of colleges and universities that don't receive more applicants than they can admit. And, you know, those are obviously not, you know, choosing on the basis of, or, you know, part of their process does not include looking at the race of candidates. But, you know, the core, I think, was this sense that in these selective universities, admissions is a zero-sum game. And so the way in which the universities were articulating things, and, you know, this is, you know, I think quite accurate, they would do a holistic review of candidates, of applicants, and would admit on the basis of, you know, this holistic review. But, you know, in a world where there's only a fixed number of slots, and that fixed number is far less than the number of applicants, any benefit to one group of candidates necessarily is a detriment to others. And I think that is really a pretty key part of how the court thought of it. And so, yes, the plaintiffs, particularly in the Harvard case, were representing Asian American applicants. And their argument was, we have been discriminated against. And you know, again, one could imagine a lot of ways to set the admissions process up, but that is the core of what the plaintiffs in the case argued.
Talking to Anuj Desai, law professor at the UW Law School, looking at this U.S. Supreme Court decision that says, hey, universities, colleges, if you're receiving money from the federal government, you can't use race as a factor in admissions. You can join in with your reactions to that, your questions about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, I mentioned close to home here. The new leader of UW-Madison, Jennifer Mnookin, put out a statement on this. I want to quote from it here. She says, we will, of course, quoting now, adapt our practices to comply with the law. At the same time, I want to reiterate that our commitment to the value of diversity within our community, including racial diversity, remains a bedrock value of the institution. Anuj, if the University of Wisconsin-Madison or any other selective school wants to maintain that value, are there tools in the toolkit they could turn to after this decision to reach that goal?
The short answer is, I think there are. So one very explicit one that the majority referred to is that schools can still take into account the essays that students write. And in particular, if a student has overcome discrimination or has been inspired in some way by, you know, Frederick Douglass or something to that effect, right? I mean, something that might be racial, but that speaks to that individual student's character, the universities are allowed to take those kinds of things into account. What they can't do, though, is take those things into account in the aggregate as to a group, right? As to a racial group, sorry. So they can take into account things that that you know relate to individuals, individuals' race, even as long as they're thinking about the individual as an individual. So that, I think that's the first thing. The second thing, and I honestly don't know enough about UW-Madison or the UW system to know all the different ways in which they, you know, they think about their admissions, but a lot of universities, including particularly Harvard, which was sued here, have preferences for example, donors, preferences for what they call legacies, that means alumni children, preferences for athletes. So those kinds of things have historically, because of the history of our country, have benefited candidates who are white. And the plaintiffs actually in the case said that they, you know, if Harvard got rid of some of those kinds of preferences, they could have an overall system in the aggregate that didn't favor a bunch of groups of people that that were primarily white. So there may be things one can do in other areas of the admissions process. I know a lot of states have what they call, you know, top 10% plans or top 3% plans, where the fact that a state might be geographically segregated becomes part of how the university itself integrates. And by that, what I mean is they basically say, whatever high school you're in, even if it's in, just to take Wisconsin's example, inner city Milwaukee, if you're at the top of, you know, top 5% or top 10% or top 3% of that school, you automatically get in. So that's something, I'm not saying they're going to do that, but Texas did that, for example, and that tends to increase racial diversity simply because there is geographic segregation. I don't use that word in its broader pejorative sense, although I think there is some of that too, but just generally speaking, you get the geographic diversity, and the geographic diversity itself can lead to some increase in racial diversity as well.
There is a bill in the state legislature along those lines. We'll be following that here at WPR. Let's bring in a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am on the side of holistic diversity, partly in terms of my own experience. I am sight disabled. I'm blind in one eye, and therefore I didn't test well on standardized entrance tests such as the SAT ones. On the other hand, by my DNA, I have some very good, some indigenous genes that gave me a very good memory. So I came out with excellent grades. So I'm two races, 14 nationalities. And so what do you, and also, but I look like a wasp. So what do you do with me?
Okay. Thanks for the call. Anuj, I want to focus in on the disability part of that. This is a ruling on race-based affirmative action here. Would it affect a program, say, offering accommodations to someone or accounting for something that says, hey, this person, because of an eye problem, has trouble taking these standardized tests?
Rob, you're exactly right. This is a case about race. The 14th Amendment, and in particular, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, the 14th Amendment is not limited to race, but Title VI of the Civil Rights Act is, and this opinion is about race. So if we're talking about disability, that would not be something that would be affected in any way. The caller did refer to her indigenous background, and I do think there are some kinds of preferences for Indigenous students, and so those may be subject to the ruling, but disability would not be.
Okay, thanks for sharing your experience. Anuj Desai is with us, law professor at the UW Law School. We're looking at the U.S. Supreme Court decision yesterday, striking down college admission policies that include racial and ethnic diversity as factors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that decision? What questions do you have about what went into it and its possible impact? Do you think college campuses should try to maintain a diverse student body, including racially and ethnically diverse? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with UW Law School professor Anuj Desai about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision this week to overturn race-based admission policies on college campuses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Milwaukee. Bob, hi.
Hey, how you doing? A quick question. So before, I guess, today, what I'm interested in is how did the colleges actually practically apply this idea of affirmative action? Was it affirmed by including some reflection of the demographic distribution of folks as a whole in the nation, or some other means that somehow afforded particular individuals some special advantage over other individuals in particular cases, hither or there, kind of subjectively? Other than that, I just had—
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, because I'm thinking that the new advantage here is like Whitey's going to be sending their kids to the inner schools, the city schools, so they can get in that top 3%, and it's going to work really great.
Bob, thanks for the call. That law's still not in place here in Wisconsin yet. But Anuj, to his main point, I imagine different colleges and universities did this a little differently. But in general, it seems like it was, you know, race could have been, before this ruling, a factor among many others. Is that the norm that we seem to have seen?
Yes, that's exactly right, Rob. The race was never a sole determinant. And I think, you know, one thing that the schools would always say is that everybody who's admitted was qualified to attend. I think what the majority saw was a pretty consistent percentage of students year after year of each of the racial groups being admitted to the schools. And that sort of gave them a clue that there really was some an attempt to make those percentages match something. And the caller's question, Bob's question, was match what? I think some the University of North Carolina tried to make it match the state of North Carolina. It is a state institution, and it generally had a lower number of African American students than the percentage of African Americans in North Carolina, which, as you probably know, is actually quite high. Harvard also attempted to make it match the number in the country, but the reality was also that Asian Americans were being admitted in numbers far above their percentage in the country. And so what in effect that meant is that that whites would be admitted in numbers lower than their percentage. But there was, it seemed from the numbers, the way the Supreme Court saw it, to be an attempt to create percentages that would be matched year after year.
Time for one more caller. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. I agree with the Supreme Court ruling. I think it's for 20, 30 years that it's been biased against a particular race and qualifications, your educational abilities, whether or not you volunteer, and being a resident of the particular state, especially in those colleges and institutions that receive either federal or state funding, especially in the case of Wisconsin, priority should be given to the state taxpayers, kids or residents that have been in the state for a long time.
Mike, so, I got you. Just about out of time. Thanks a lot for the call, Mike. And with just our last half a minute or so, Anuj, are you watching for a future case, a future challenge, the way universities do these things?
I'm not watching for one, but it really will depend on what the universities do and how people respond to it. So if the universities continue to use race in a way that the courts are skeptical of, then I suspect there will be lawsuits. But as you heard from Chancellor Mnuchin, I think most universities are committed to following the law as the Supreme Court has laid it down. And there may be disagreements on the margins about what exactly that means, but I suspect most universities will at least try to follow the law. But there may be disagreements about what it means going forward, and then there will be more lawsuits.
Thanks to our guest today. Anuj Desai is a law professor at the UW Law School. He joined us for a look at the U.S. Supreme Court decision blocking colleges and universities from using race as a factor in admissions. If you are listening right now to the 90.9 FM signal in Madison, when you wake up tomorrow, I invite you to switch to 90.5 FM. That to 90.9 is going away. Better signal at 90.5 coming up tomorrow. Coming up after the news, we learn more about the new science of using MDMA, also called ecstasy or Molly, to help treat post-traumatic stress disorder and the long history of the drug stretching back to its invention in 1912. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're going to learn from a pair of restaurant owners and master composters how to cut our own food waste down to zero, and we'll enjoy some new recipes while doing it. First, new research shows that MDMA, also known as ecstasy or Molly, has a lot of potential to help heal severe cases of things like post-traumatic stress disorder. MDMA has been a popular party drug and a Schedule I controlled substance, the most restrictive level of drug control in the U.S. It has a history full of twists and turns, stretching back to 1912 and featuring use by therapists, ravers, and government agents trying to discover a truth serum during the Cold War. As with some other psychedelic drugs, scientists are discovering that MDMA has the potential to help address not just PTSD, but depression, addiction, existential anxiety faced by terminal patients, and more. In a new book, our next guest traces the past, present, and future of MDMA as a therapy and in recreational use. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used MDMA, and are you willing to share that story? What was your experience like with it? What do you want to know about how the drug works, its safety, or its potential to help PTSD and other mental health problems? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Rachel Neuer is a journalist and author. Her new book is I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
A lot of fascinating stories in your book. What led you, Rachel, to dig into this history of MDMA?
Oh, man, I just felt like the time was really ripe for MDMA to get its own story. You know, Michael Pollan really covered LSD and psilocybin in his book, How to Change Your Mind, a few years ago. But MDMA is a molecule with just as rich a history and a story in terms of politics, culture, science, and mental health.
Take us back to the invention of this drug in 1912, I think you write. And then it seems like people didn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, the story really begins on Christmas Eve 1912 when the German pharmaceutical company Merck filed a patent for MDMA, but they weren't actually looking for MDMA. It was just a chemical intermediary on a series of steps they were taking to get to a blood clotting agent. Merck denies that they ever realized that MDMA actually had psychoactive properties. That denial is a little questionable, but yeah, it popped up again in the 1950s during the U.S.'s search for a chemical truth serum, really unethical period in U.S. history when the CIA and the Army were doing tests on American citizens and Army soldiers. We don't actually know if MDMA was ever given to anybody. We haven't found that sort of smoking gun document to prove that the Army did give pay people MDMA. What we do know, though, is that it reemerged in 1975 in the Bay Area when a chemist resynthesized it and introduced it to the therapeutic community.
Before we dig more into the history, I want to talk a little bit about what the drug MDMA does. And a weird thing is it depends. It seems like the experience might be very different if I'm sitting down for a therapy session with talk therapists and taking this versus I'm on a dance floor with 120 beats per minute electronic music going. Why is it so, what do we know about why it's so context dependent?
Yeah, well, like most or all, in fact, psychedelic drugs, it's really about the set and the setting. So that refers to your mindset, what you're going into the experience, your mental baggage, your expectations, and the actual physical setting. So I have never done MDMA in a therapeutic context, but, you know, I've heard people who have say, you know, I don't know why they call this ecstasy. This is not an ecstatic experience. This is really difficult, hard, profound work. Whereas if you're just going in to have some light fun and dance all night with your friends, you're going to have a completely different experience. It is going to be euphoric. You're going to feel a deep sense of connection on the dance floor. You're probably going to have a really good time.
And your book shares a title with the great Donna Summer groundbreaking song, I Feel Love. And that is apparently a common, not a universal, but a common part of an experience using this drug.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, without knowing the title of my book, quite a few of my interview subjects use that exact phrase that, oh, you know, I felt love on this drug, or I even felt love for myself or for others for the first time in my entire life, in the case of some highly traumatized people.
Talking to Rachel Neuer about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA, and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rachel, you write that there was a period where we had people experimenting with MDMA as a therapy. Then it becomes outlawed effectively in 1985. Can you talk about that process that made it a Schedule I drug?
Yes. So therapists were introduced to MDMA quietly beginning in 1975, 1976, and it spread from the Bay Area out across the US and even to Europe. And they found that this was a really phenomenal tool that they could apply to pretty much any form of psychotherapy, whether it was couples therapy, helping people to process their trauma, or just helping people get more deeply in touch with themselves. But they knew that they needed to keep quiet about this new drug because they had seen what had happened to LSD a few years before. LSD in the 50s was given to some 40,000 patients around the world as a therapeutic aid, but then it was politicized, it was criminalized, it was outlawed. And they knew that if the US federal government caught wind of this new drug, the same fate would befall it. Well, lo and behold, that is what happened. The DEA caught wind of MDMA. They moved to schedule it, to put it on Schedule One, which is the most strictly banned substances with no current medical value, a high potential for abuse. The therapeutic community actually fought back against this. They put together a case, and they took the DEA to court. This was therapists, doctors, even Harvard professors arguing to the DEA that MDMA should in fact be a Schedule III drug, which would permit its use in medical context and also allow research to continue. They actually won that case. The administrative law judge sided with them and said, yes, MDMA should be Schedule III. But because it was an administrative case, the DEA only took that judgment as an opinion. And they just did, I guess, what they had planned to do all along, which was put MDMA on Schedule I, where it has remained ever since.
things have loosened up some, you write, more people are able to do research. And I want to get into what seems to be the most advanced, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. What are therapists doing with MDMA for people with PTSD?
Yes. So this has been about a 20-year effort to test MDMA-assisted therapy's effectiveness for PTSD. You know, it's just taken that long because of bureaucracy and also because researchers cannot easily get federal funding to test Schedule I substances. So that's why it's taken so long. But the results so far are really promising. The most recent phase 3 clinical trial, and this is 2 out of 3 necessary phase 3 trials before the drug can gain FDA approval, the results were very, very promising. About 2/3 of the 100 or so participants emerged after just 3 sessions of MDMA assisted therapy with no longer qualifying for a PTSD diagnosis. And these are people with severe cases of PTSD, with histories of suicidal ideation, with substance abuse disorders. They had had PTSD for something like, you know, 16 years on average. So these are really, really promising results that sort of blow out of the water any results we've seen from just talk therapy alone or traditional pharmaceuticals.
A lot of your book deals with the stories of people who have used MDMA for treatment. Can you share a little bit about the people you met who had been through PTSD treatment involving MDMA?
Oh gosh, there were so many stories. And, you know, many of them were really emotional for me to hear. You know, I heard from a veteran who had served in Vietnam and come back with really severe PTSD that he didn't recognize himself. And he lived with this crippling condition literally for decades until his wife was basically gave him an ultimatum and said, you have to get help for this or I can't stay with you. And after he did MDMA assisted therapy, he was finally able to recognize that deep, deep wound he had suffered as a result of what happened to him in Vietnam and begin to connect with himself, to forgive himself, and even to connect with his wife. He said that was the most beautiful thing that he got out of this. Now he's not afraid to talk to her and be honest with her about his feelings.
And I want to spell this out a little. This isn't, I get a prescription for an MDMA pill, I go home and I take it once a day or once a month or whatever. Can you talk through the process that people went through in this therapy?
Yeah, absolutely. That is such an important point. This isn't, yeah, here's your MDMA, go home and take it. And this also isn't, okay, well, we're going to meet here, you know, every week and take MDMA for the rest of your life. It's not a one and done process, but it's a lot closer to that model than something like traditional SSRIs or talk therapy would be. So you have a few sessions where you meet with a therapist, you talk about your issues, you talk about what you're hoping to get out of the actual medication session. Then on the day of, you meet with 2 therapists, ideally a man and a woman, and you put on blindfold, eye shades, you put on headphones, you take the pill, you lie back on a couch or a bed, and you wait for the drug to take effect. Some people, once it does take effect, get really chatty. You know, they want to talk to their therapist. They want to process things out loud. Some people go deep inside themselves and barely say a word the entire time. The whole thing takes about 7 or 8 hours. It's an entire day. For the clinical trials, at least, it was 3 sessions spaced a month apart. But in terms of the ideal number of sessions, that's something scientists and therapists are going to have to work out once this treatment is approved. You know, for some people, it could be fewer. For some people, it could be more.
We're talking to journalist and author Rachel Neuer about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you or a loved one have experienced PTSD, would you be willing to try this MDMA-assisted therapy? Have you sought it out yourself? Do you think MDMA should be legalized for medicinal use, for recreational use? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with journalist and author Rachel Neuer. Her new book is called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for a Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the latest research on the use of MDMA? that's often called ecstasy or Molly more recently, and other psychedelics to help with things like PTSD and other mental health conditions. Do you have experience with this particular drug yourself that you're willing to tell us about? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel, I want to talk about why this particular drug might help in this particular way. And some of the research is looking at the idea of a critical period in our brains. Talk us through that.
Yeah, so researchers have wondered for years why it is that something that is so short-acting like MDMA can have such profound lasting effects. And new neuroscience coming out of the lab of Gul Dolin at Johns Hopkins seems to perhaps provide an answer to that question. So under the set and setting of therapy, so when you go in prime to interact with your trauma and with a therapist's guidance, the brain seems to reopen what neuroscientists call a critical period. Critical periods are finite periods of malleability, usually that occur in childhood, when the brain is primed to learn new things, to make new connections, to set us up with the habits that will give us a lifetime of success out here in the world. It's why, for example, children can learn a new language so much easier than we adults can. What MDMA seems to do under that therapeutic guidance is reopen a social reward learning critical period. And this allows people to really reevaluate and reassess their trauma, the stories they've told themselves about their trauma, about themselves, the habits they formed around that trauma. If you think about typical PTSD symptoms. So you're literally rewiring your brain when you do MDMA-assisted therapy, which is what makes it so powerful if these results are indeed accurate.
What is the frontier of research on this now, trying to connect the dots between using something like MDMA in a therapy session and making these changes?
Yeah, I mean, there's very interesting research on the horizon. There's already been studies on using MDMA for severe social anxiety in autistic adults. There are studies going on in the UK now for MDMA's use for treating alcohol addiction. What I think is really interesting is if these critical period results hold up, then MDMA and actually other psychedelic drugs could be so-called master keys for reopening critical periods. And what that means is if you tune the set and setting, if instead of doing talk therapy, for example, you do occupational therapy, you could reopen a different critical period for motor learning. So at Johns Hopkins, they're now pursuing the idea of giving stroke patients MDMA and then giving them occupational therapy to see if they can regain much, much greater mobility than they would without the drug.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good. What did you want to share with us?
Okay, so I was in the military from the periods of 2001 to 2008, and I did two tours of combat while I was in, and stress has really taken a toll just kind of like on my mental health. And I've tried different therapies as far as, you know, talk therapy, and I couldn't connect with the people enough to feel comfortable enough sharing everything that I've been through. I have just recently been exposed to microdosing with psilocybin, but I haven't started yet or tried it. But how can somebody that, like myself, whose profession really hinders their ability to seek all therapies, try something different that might work?
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm sorry you're dealing with this and haven't found a solution, at least not yet. But Rachel, Aaron's story sounds like a lot of the people you talk to in the book. And something he mentioned, he has a hard time being able to fully open up about his experiences in a talk therapy session. That's something you heard, I think, actually from veterans in your research.
Absolutely. Yeah, Aaron, thank you so much for sharing that story. And just know that you absolutely are not alone in these feelings. one of the beautiful things about MDMA-assisted therapy is the drug lowers activity in the amygdala, which is the brain's fear center. So people don't feel just our natural reaction to keep things to ourselves, to protect ourselves, to present a certain image of ourselves to the world. We're better able to just be ourselves and be open. MDMA also increases feelings of connection with other people, which really helps in terms of the therapeutic process and kind of speeding the process of building trust with your therapists. As far as accessing MDMA under the context of your current job, unfortunately, it is still currently illegal. So you're going to have to wait if you want to do it legally until the FDA approves it. But hopefully that will happen by this time next year. And I should add too that there are now trials going on at VAs around the country. I have not heard of any in Wisconsin, but you can look those up. There's one in the Bronx. There's one in Oregon, in Texas.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. We are talking to Rachel Neuer about her new book, I Feel Love, MDMA, and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Back to your calls now. Ruth Ann is with us in Madison. Ruth Ann, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my question, actually I have two of them, but I know that people experience PTSD for a variety of reasons, whether you're in the war, you could experience it from a bad car accident, also, you know, like from childhood traumas of every kind. So is there a type of PTSD that this works better for? I've not read your book, and maybe it's answered in there, but I'd like to read your book. I was also curious about how young or what's the ages that this can be used for other than adults, if so. So those are my questions.
Ruth Ann, thanks for the call. Rachel, you did talk to people who experienced different causes of PTSD. Your thoughts for Ruth Ann?
Yeah, both excellent questions. So the clinical trials involved not just veterans, but people with all forms of PTSD from childhood, from sexual assault, first responders, from natural disasters, things like that. And the results held up across the board. This seems to be an effective treatment regardless of the source of your PTSD. So that's great news. In terms of, what was the second part of that question?
How young are people being in trials for?
So these trials were for adults, but actually the FDA, if they approve MDMA-assisted therapy, there is a requirement that adolescents then have to go through clinical trials as well. So this could wind up being a treatment that can be given to adolescents as well, but we're going to have to await those safety and efficacy results.
Ruth Ann, thanks for the call. Rachel, I should ask, people might be listening thinking, hey, this is a Schedule I controlled substance. Aren't there risks? Are there harms? What do we know?
Yeah, definitely. MDMA, like anything, you know, like water, like aspirin, can be unsafe and even deadly if you take too much of it or you take it under the wrong circumstances. In a therapist's office, there have been no serious side effects or emergencies or anything like that. However, if you do take it out in the world illegally, you run the risk of taking tainted drugs because, again, you're having to buy the drug illegally. You don't know what you're getting unless you test it yourself. You also run the risk of accidentally taking too much MDMA and overdosing yourself if you're not testing the drugs for the percentage content and then weighing out an appropriate sample. The two things that tend to occur most often in terms of emergencies and even deaths from MDMA are overheating. So you're dancing all night, you're not drinking water, you're not taking breaks, and you perhaps took too much MDMA. And also some people wind up drinking too much water, and MDMA causes the body to retain water. So if you start chugging gallons of water, you can cause something called the name escapes me, but it lowers your sodium levels in your blood, which can cause your brain cells to swell, and that can be deadly. So hyponatremia, that is the name.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your book with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Rachel Neuer, journalist and author. She talked to us about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk to the co-authors of the new cookbook, Perfectly Good Food, a totally achievable approach to zero waste cooking. If you have a way to cut back on food waste that is working for you, we want to hear about it. You can post right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.